During the last few minutes of this sitting, as you're continuing to meditate, I would like to read for you. I would like to read to you the Heart Sutra, which is the great, probably the most chanted sutra, the sacred discourse in the history of Buddhism. Chanted over and over and over again daily by many people. It's a Mahayana sutra, comes from traditions of Tibet and China and Japan. It's said to be a mantra. A mantra has almost magical powers. It's said to have protective powers. Those who chant it and listen to it are protected. It's said to have strong liturgical powers, and those who chant it and recite it, just taking in the words, not thinking about it, not thinking about the teaching, but just letting the words impact your mind, your heart. Some people report that it stops their minds, it shifts their perspective of things. It's considered quite sacred as a text. So one of the more traditional titles is the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. When practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceive that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance and also no extinction of it, until no old age and death and also no extinction of it, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on the perfection of insight, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on prajna paramita, on the perfection of insight, and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the perfection of insight mantra is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the perfection of insight mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Para Gate, Parasam Gate, Bodhisvaha. So I was inspired to read the Heart Sutra from having gone to the teachings by the Dalai Lama this last week. I was there for Thursday and Friday. And it was quite an inspiring event in many ways to be there. And it certainly was inspiring to hear the Dalai Lama speak about the Heart Sutra, and it was, you know, you get a sense of the profundity of the text. It was a little bit difficult, especially on Friday, to understand it all, because he went through a tremendous amount of depth and history and scholarship around this very profound discourse of the Buddha's, or Mahayana discourse. And so it's been on my mind, on my heart, kind of since then. And I gave a talk yesterday morning about it, and I wasn't sure if I'd do one today, but it's still kind of, you know, very alive for me, and so that's what you'll get. The discourse on the Heart Sutra is it's called the Heart Sutra, the Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra, which in Sanskrit, Hridaya means heart, and the perfection of wisdom. Prajna Paramita means the perfection of wisdom. So here it's titled The Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom. Prajna is usually translated as wisdom. Paramita means, usually translated as perfection. It means that which takes you beyond. Para means beyond, meaning that which takes you into the transcendental experience or transcendental truths or realization, that which takes you beyond, that which is beyond, that which is ultimate. It's kind of problematic how exactly to translate it, but prajna paramita, perfection of insight. Heart is usually understood to mean, it's called heart because it's the core teaching. As the perfection of wisdom, there's a whole body of literature called the perfection of wisdom literature. And it gets longer and longer. There's perfection of wisdom in one letter, which is all condensed, and all the teachings are condensed into one. Oh, sort of the other direction. There's a perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines, and which there's the perfection of wisdom in 25,000 lines. The abbreviated translation into English is this big. So the 100,000 is quite a bit bigger. And this is abbreviated. And then there's the perfection of wisdom in 18,000 lines, the perfection of wisdom, I think, in 10,000 lines. One of the most important ones is the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, which is what I did my dissertation on. And then you have the 500 lines. They're kind of organized by how long they are. And there's one of 150 lines, and then, which I did my master's thesis on. And then there's 25 lines, and then there's perfection of wisdom in one letter.
Which letter is it?
Ah. That one. And so whenever you have the great, joyful kind of enunciation of letting go, you're expressing in a condensed form the wisdom of tremendous body of wisdom. The Heart Sutra is considered, many people think, as the kind of the condensation of this great body of wisdom, this great collection of texts, but also it's called heart because heart in ancient India and also in China, and Chinese Buddhism, had also the meaning a mantra. So it's called the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. And what they often did in ancient India was they started putting mantras as being a condensation of a certain body of teachings. And the different mantras had different functions. Mantras are not just kind of mantras are particular words that have certain powers. And rather than being words that were kind of just syllables of sounds, the Buddhist mantras often had meanings associated with them. And so the meaning was very significant in the mantra. But the mantra condensed in a kind of magical way, in a powerful way, the power, the sense, the meaning of the particular text that So this is the perfection of wisdom mantra, the mantra of the perfection of insight. And then there's this beginning that leads up to the mantra, which is at the end. For most of its history, especially in ancient India and China and Japan, the mantric purpose of this text was much more important than the doctrinal. And most people, and the mantric effect was a protective quality. Travelers would carry it with them and use it to protect them as they went through different parts of Asia traveling. When I was in the monasteries in Japan, there was one young 21-year-old monk who came from a village, country kind of temple someplace, rural Japan, and he was visited by ghosts, which frightened him a lot, and until he started chanting the Heart Sutra. And the Heart Sutra turned out to be very effective to protect you from ghosts, and then he was not bothered anymore. So if you have ghosts in your neighborhood, you can recite this text. And also the liturgical, as I said earlier, liturgical power of the text is very much appreciated by many people who do Buddhist liturgy, which I did for many years living in Zen centers. We chanted it every day. And it has a certain power on the mind, kind of like a poem. If you memorize and recite a poem regularly, it has a certain power that's very different than if you sit down and just study the meaning of the poem and analyze it analytically. If you kind of live with a poem for a while and it kind of enters your blood and your cells and it starts popping up in unusual ways or different days, suddenly a new perspective or new light gets thrown on the poem that wouldn't have happened, you know, if you just read it once or something. And the same thing happens with liturgy. You recite the same thing over and over again. You've more than memorized it. It's kind of entered into your cells. And it starts having a life in your life, which is, I know a lot of Zen students will appreciate quite a bit. I did quite a bit. And then there's also the doctrinal purposes of the text. And down through the centuries, many people have appreciated giving Dharma talks on the meaning of the Heart Sutra, the doctrinal meaning. There's a kind of core doctrinal, kind of common doctrinal interpretation of the Heart Sutra that a lot of people will share. But the core interpretation, which is kind of standard, often is kind of just an ink blot for people going off in all kinds of tangents and talking about all kinds of other interpretations from that. So you have in Japan, for example, in modern Japan, you have all these books, because in Japan the Heart Sutra is like one of the core Bibles of the whole culture. So there's a lot of books written on the Heart Sutra, and you find the Heart Sutra inscribed in cups and, you know, everywhere in Japan the Heart Sutra is inscribed. Even probably in your underwear you find underwear with the Heart Sutra on it. And so you find Marxist interpretations of the Heart Sutra, you find capitalist interpretations of the Heart Sutra, you find psychological, you know, the Heart Sutra is applied everywhere in life. So what I thought I'd do is go through the Heart Sutra a little bit, give you my particular take on it, and you can do with that what you wish. I'm very fond of the fact that the Heart Sutra is framed in the context of compassion. First of all, it concerns the practice of the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva is a person who has oriented their life, organized their life around trying to respond to the suffering in the world. And you don't have to go very far to realize the world has a lot of suffering. And these are people who are sensitive to that suffering in the world and decided to organize their life not around their own pleasure or their own well-being or their own whatever, but rather they're organizing their life around trying to respond in a helpful way in the suffering of the world. And not just any old way, but trying to address the suffering of the world at its core. The core issues of what causes suffering in the world, the core issues of attachment to self, for example. So this is understood to be the compassionate. Bodhisattva is a person who's dedicated their life towards compassion. So that's the framework, the foundation of background for this text. Then it opens up by evoking the bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara bodhisattva is how the text begins. Avalokiteshvara was a man in India, great bodhisattva of compassion. became androgynous in China, and then at some point in China was transformed into a woman. And a lot of people in the Japanese Buddhist tradition will think of Avalokiteshvara as a woman. Kuan Yin, most of you think of Kuan Yin as a woman?
Yeah.
Well, Kuan Yin is the Chinese word for Avalokiteshvara. In Tibet, Tibetan Buddhism has these wonderful ways in which the Bodhisattva manifest themselves in all kinds of different forms. So rather than having a sex change, Avalokiteshvara just took different forms and different... So Chenrezig is the male form in Tibetan Buddhism, and Tara is one of the female forms of Avalokiteshvara. So I like this, the evoking of the great personification of compassion, the great perfection of compassion. It puts you kind of in the mood to think about compassion, or be reminded, you're of compassion, maybe evoked. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceived all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. To be saved from all suffering is the ultimate goal of Buddhism. So this isn't just kind of a thing to kind of read over casually, but to make this claim, was saved from all suffering, is saying that this particular practice that Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva was practicing was the instrumental practice that helped her or him to do the ultimate Buddhist task, which is to be saved, freed from all suffering. So, wow, you know, now all the Buddhists wake up. Not only is compassion evoked, but what it takes to be fully liberated is evoked there in the opening. So we want to know what this text has to say. I translate the Prajna Paramita as the perfection of insight. Maybe that's a poor choice, but I choose that because wisdom has a different connotation than insight. Wisdom is something you can acquire in wisdom and carry that with you in your life. And it's kind of like you have this understanding that you have that's good, and you carry with you and apply it in all kinds of situations. Insight has the connotation of something that you're applying to your life right now. Or not applying. It's insight is something you see right now. You perceive right now. It's you see into something and you perceive its nature, and you have that insight. The perfection of wisdom involves seeing in the moment the true nature of our situation. And that's what it says. Practicing deeply the perfection of insight, Avalokiteshvara perceived, which is an act of insight, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty. All five skandhas are the categories the Buddha used to describe the psychophysical human being. So in the West, we might say the psychophysical human being, the psychological and the physical. And everything we are as a human being then is put underneath those categories, psychophysical human beings. Or some people will say, who we are is we're a body, we're a mind, and we're a heart. And so just kind of abstract kind of categories then to lump everything we are, and we have to figure out how to put everything in there. The Buddha wanted to use five categories to divide up the human being, and everything who we are is supposed to fit into these five categories. It's like the using a metric measuring system as opposed to the English measuring system. There's nothing absolutely true about it, except that's the measuring system, and we fit everything into the metric system, those of us who, are in Europe. So this is the Buddhist metric system for the human being, is the five skandhas. And they are form, our physical experience, our physicality, feeling, which is vedana, which is either you know or you don't know what that means in the Buddhist language, I won't go into it. Perception, mental formations, which is the whole world of dispositions, thoughts, ideas, intentions, past conditioning that you have in your mind. And then consciousness, the faculty of awareness. These might be kind of coarse, they might be not very useful categories, but they're the ones the Buddha came up with. And what it's understood to mean is any aspect of who we are that we can point to, this is who I am, this makes up who I am, this is part of who I am, This is what it means to be a human being in terms of our direct kind of... All those things that we can put in that category, none of that, or all of that, in its essence, is empty. What does that mean? It's all empty. Well, he goes on to explain. In the next paragraph, the discourse goes on. O Shariputra. So now Avalokiteshvara is speaking, and Shariputra is evoking or speaking to Shariputra. Shariputra, in Mahayana discourses and sutras, is a little bit of a sad person. Because, see, in the early discourses of the Buddha, Shariputra was the right-hand lieutenant, or the right-hand, you know, person for the Buddha. There was no one who had as much wisdom and understanding after the Buddha than Shariputra. And Shariputra was the symbolic representative, or symbolic, was the person who kind of embodied the full understanding of the Abhidharma. There's a very complicated body of literature in Buddhism called the Abhidharma, which is very analytical, which defines terms and analyzes our reality to the nth degree. It takes years to study this complicated analytical, kind of like, you know, how many angels can be on a pin. It's, you know, that's how some people see it. That's how the Mahayana saw that literature. Mahayana thought that literature missed the point. And so they're telling Shariputra how things really are. So for the people in the early tradition, it's just like, you know, you don't tell Shariputra anything unless you're the Buddha. So, and then it's going to go through some of the important categories of analysis of the early tradition, and it's going to say they're all empty. They're going to negate them all. So the five skandhas, this five aggregates of human being, is one of those categories the Buddha used. And it's going to say, these don't exist, or they're empty. So when I was a Zen student, I didn't know much about Buddhism when I first became a Zen student, but I had memorized this text, and it said, you know, no five skandhas. The five skandhas are empty. No form, no feelings, no perceptions, no mental formations, no consciousness. So I concluded from that I didn't have to learn what those were. Because they were empty. They didn't exist in some way. Well, what this text presupposes, I learned many years later, is that you're supposed to know these really well. And once you know them, then you can pull the rug from underneath you from them. But you're not supposed to ignore their existence because they're empty. You're supposed to actually learn them. So, O Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. What does that mean? It said form and emptiness are the same. Form is not different than emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. Emptiness is a characteristic of form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. It's a characteristic. What this means is water is a characteristic, wetness is a characteristic of water. Heat is a characteristic of fire. Generally, you don't have water without wetness. You kind of don't have wetness without water. I guess other liquids can be wet too. You don't have heat separate from fire. And if you kind of stretch it a little bit, you don't have fire separate from heat, and you don't have heat separate from fire, because heat is a characteristic of fire. Wetness is a characteristic of water. In that same way, emptiness is a characteristic of the five skandhas. It goes on and says, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. Dharmas here means all things. All things are marked with emptiness. They're characterized by emptiness. You won't find emptiness apart from the things that you look at. So it's not negating the existence of these things. It's not saying these things don't exist. It's saying the way that they exist, they have the characteristic of being empty. And if you have the ability to perceive, to have insight, to look insightfully at these things, you'll be able to see that the characteristic of all things is they're empty. How are they empty? And this is where the most common, most standard interpretation of the Heart Sutra comes into place. The most common interpretation is they're empty of any intrinsic essence which endures permanently through time. That because all things are impermanent and arises because of causes and conditions, they are empty of any permanent abiding essence within those things. So a table, there's no inherent tableness in the table. The table is empty of inherent tableness. What that means is that a table is a table when we call it a table, when we use it as a table, but sometimes we use it as a stepping stool, or sometimes we use it as a massage table, or sometimes we use it as, we turn it upside down and we use it as a, you know, fort, or use it as, you know, my 3-year-old doesn't think a table is a table, he thinks it's his, you know, clubhouse. There's nothing inherent that requires that to remain a table. The table is, so it's empty of tableness, it's empty of inherent essence. And because everything arises from causes and conditions, everything is empty of this inherent essence. So that's, you know, so what? Those of you who are not philosophically inclined, so what? So then the text goes on and says, because of that, all things are marked with emptiness, and because of that, they do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. So that sounds patently absurd. Things increase and decrease. Maybe, you know, we've rebelled against the, you know, our Catholic background, so we don't want to see things as being pure or tainted. Whatever. So, but so that's okay. But they don't increase or decrease. You know, what does that mean? All things don't increase and decrease. I mean, you look down at your weight and you think, you know, I wish that was the case. Or something like that. Or there goes all my hope. What it means, this is the standard interpretation now, is that what it means is that since things don't exist in any essential way over time, things are only, it's very difficult to explain, but if you look at if you take a movie and project it onto a screen, and you get into the movie and you get excited, you cry when the heroine gets, you know, whatever happens, and you're really into it, your mind is caught by the movie and involved with the movie, it's engaged with the movie. If you slow the projector down dramatically, so you only have one frame being shot at the screen every 10 seconds or every 30 seconds, then it becomes obvious to you that there's no real movement happening up there. No one seems to slowly appear onto the screen and slowly disappear. No one seems to increase and decrease, kind of grow and shrink. It just, there's a still frame on the screen, and then another still frame appears, and then another still frame appears. No one says there's any enduring essence that moves through. It's actually quite disconcerting, because you think originally you saw it motion, but actually there's no motion at all. It's just, you know, and the mind kind of, if it goes fast enough, the mind constructs motion. But motion doesn't happen at all on the screen. We're being fooled. They're using our mind's ability to abstract to fool us into thinking there's motion, and then we cry. So in the same way, reality appears the same way as that movie screen. It has no essential essence to it. It endures through time. It doesn't appear or disappear. It doesn't increase or decrease. It just exists as it exists for the moment. It didn't slowly appear. It didn't slowly disappear. It's there for a moment and then it's not there. Because it has no enduring essence, they want to argue, it also is not an issue of being tainted or pure. So that's a standard interpretation. There's other interpretations. You might not find it satisfying, you might find it very satisfying, I don't know, but just present it. Therefore, in emptiness, from the point of view of this emptiness, seeing all these things being empty and of intrinsic nature, there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, until no realm of mind consciousness. I have a nose, I have ears, I have eyes. What are these people saying? One interpretation is they're saying there's no essential eye, no essential nose. Nose doesn't exist apart from everything else that creates it and brings it together. The nose is a dependently originate phenomena. There is no essential essence in your nose. Therefore, they can say there's no nose. Is that satisfying? But that's what, you know, that's one interpretation. Then, and now for Vipassana students who are supposed to be paying careful attention to their direct experience, taste, smell, touch, all these things, to be told that the taste, touch, smell doesn't exist, you know, it's a little bit discouraging, maybe. Then it goes on to say that there's no ignorance and no extinction of it, no old age and death, and also no extinction of it. What this refers to is one of the most important lists in early Buddhism. It's shorthand for it. And that is the wheel of the dependent origination, which is the Buddha's description of the genesis of suffering. Very important list. And here it's saying this: no ignorance, no 12 links, and no ending of it. So for someone who's deeply steeped in Buddhism, this is a little disconcerting first to hear this, for Shariputra especially. And then it goes on to negate the Four Noble Truths. If anything is the central teachings of Buddhism, of the Buddha, if anything is really the core, it's the Four Noble Truths. And here it says, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no ending of suffering, and no path to the ending of suffering. My God, what's left to negate? No cognition. Cognition, I mean, that's what I practice, is mindfulness, is cognizing, being aware of what goes on. And no attainment. You know, well, what do you mean no attainment? If there's no attainment in Buddhism, why bother? I mean, I might as well, you know, take up something more fun. I mean, I could, you know, go bowling, you know. You know, at least in bowling, you know, there's some kind of attainment occasionally. But, and you know, you have to get some exercise and all that. But here they say in Buddhism there's no attainment. So it's kind of a shocking thing to say. And that's part of the value of this text, is kind of a shock value to every day to say these things. You know, what does this mean? Even the most common interpretation I gave you, kind of, you know, I understand that now, great, you know, okay, no essential essence in this. It doesn't deny the existence of these things, because emptiness is a characteristic of these things. So, I'm not really, they really exist, but they don't really exist in essential essence. They arise in dependence of all other things together. But every day that you read this, you know, no eyes, no ears, no attainment, no origination, it kind of has this impact that begins, is that all it is to it? Is this, you know, it must be more than just this philosophical interpretation. Because then it goes on to say, with nothing to attain. And this is where the text shifts, because if the philosophical interpretation, if you follow that, you can still have an attainment as long as your insight shows you that attainment is empty. Right? It's a characteristic of your attainment is that it's empty, but you still have the attainment. But here it says, with nothing to attain. You're supposed to take this, you're supposed to take, understand it a little bit differently. You're supposed to understand it that actually, because everything is empty, there's nothing for you to attain. Okay, let's sign up for the bowling league. Nothing to attain. So this is, you know, this is quite disconcerting for Buddhists, because some promise of some attainment, making progress in your meditation and some liberation, and, you know, kind of what keeps people motivated. But nothing to attain. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva, this being who organizes their life around compassion, depends on the perfection of insight. And the mind is no hindrance. The mind has no hindrance, no obstacles. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Now that gets our interest. I'd like to be without any fears. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. This is sounding more hopeful now, because the whole purpose of Buddhism is to dwell in nirvana, attain nirvana, ultimate liberation. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on the perfection of insight and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. The attainment has come back. So, with nothing to attain, you practice the perfection of insight. If you do this, and this is the practice that brought all Buddhas to their full Buddhahood, to their full enlightenment. To be fully liberated is really the purpose of Buddhism, to be freed of all suffering. And again, this text is saying this is how it was done by the Buddhas. With nothing to attain. So somehow the bodhisattvas were practicing or having this perspective, this insight of emptiness, that there was nothing to attain. But they put their trust in, their dependence on this insight, the perfection of wisdom, perfection of insight. Now if we analyze or look a little bit at where we tend to put our trust, what do we tend to depend on in the life that we live? And we don't usually think very deeply about what, in terms of what we operate, what are the operating things we depend on, what are the way we live our life and make our choices in our life, what does it really depend on? We depend on all kinds of things that maybe are not very dependable. We depend on, for example, we trust, for example, that it's valuable to defend ourselves. We trust and feel it's valuable to build up a strong sense of self and to protect it and to project it. We think it's dependable to get angry with people. We trust that it's useful to kind of to build up savings accounts. We put our trust in relationships. We put our trust and dependence on a particular way of seeing the world, a worldview. There's a whole bunch of things we put our trust on that's almost implicit and unexamined, because it's almost like the air we breathe. We don't even see it. One of the most fundamental ones has to do with the sense of self. Self-image, self-representation, self-clinging, just a sense of self, which is so funny, you know, it goes unexamined by people because it's taken for granted. A tremendous amount of dependence goes into the belief in a self. The bodhisattva is not depending on any of that, not putting a trust in any of that. The only thing the bodhisattva puts trust in is in the perfection of insight, in this insight into emptiness. I like to interpret this as being that the bodhisattva puts their trust in awareness. They live in awareness, and their entire trust goes into being aware. And they don't trust anything else. Now, trusting awareness can feel very frightening, because you can't hold on to it. It doesn't do you any good, does it? But to trust awareness, to rest and live in awareness, and then to allow the innate intelligence of who we are to act. Many of us feel like we have to prepare ahead of time and manipulate, and we don't trust who we are innately and very deeply. And not to let the innate intelligence operate, which means if you enter a conversation and you don't have anything to say, you're silent. Or that's one small meaning of it. But the innate intelligence is understood that arises out of emptiness, arises out of depending on emptiness, or depending on no attainment, or depending on awareness itself. Also, that innate intelligence, it's said, I don't know how to prove this, that's true for everyone, but the theory at least, and kind of the faith that many of us have, is that, or it's our own experience for ourselves, is that in emptiness comes compassion. When the mind is not preoccupied or fixated on anything, then it's a space in the heart to be sensitive to the suffering of the world. And then compassion is a natural result. In fact, they say that you don't have to even be aware of the suffering of the world. It's just innate in the heart, in who we are, that compassion is there when it's not obstructed. The innate intelligence that pops up when we can depend, when we trust awareness and rest in awareness. The perfection of insight. So there's two ways of understanding the perfection of insight. One is it's the insight into the characteristic of emptiness in things. You have to be present for things to see it, but to see the emptiness. And the other interpretation is that it means more radically simply to trust awareness itself. It's kind of the same thing, because if you see the emptiness of things, one of the reasons why seeing the emptiness of things is so profound is when you see that things are empty, you realize that you cannot, that it doesn't make sense to grasp them. And if you don't grasp on anything, you're left with awareness free and open. So it kind of comes to the same thing. By depending on the perfection of insight, the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. And then, far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. The mind is no hindrance. This is why this text is a protective text. The ultimate protection that we need is from ourselves. And this is really the core, one of the core teachings of Buddhism, is that, and this is very challenging, you're not supposed to believe it, you're supposed to be challenged and argue with it and come up with all the reasons why this is not true. One of the core teachings of Buddhism is that you are responsible for your own suffering. Now, you're supposed to get angry, you're supposed to get upset, you know, how can that be? You know, when I was a kid, this happened to me, and that's why I suffer now. But you really have to take, it is a very deep and very profound teaching that you're responsible for your suffering. And you're supposed to grapple with that and really try to penetrate to the depths of your being what this might mean. But for now, we'll just take it as for granted. You're responsible for your suffering. And if you're going to be protected from suffering, you have to be protected from yourself. And the way you're protected from yourself is to have no hindrances in your mind, no fears in your mind, no clinging, no aversion in your own mind. Because your suffering arises out of your fear and clinging and aversion. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. This is also a lot of this is kind of like, this is like cliff notes for Buddhism. so you have to done a lot of study in Buddhism to know what all this refers to. Perverted view. So this thing about seeing the characteristics of stuff as everything is being empty is supposed to be an antidote to the perverted way that most of us assign characteristics to things that are not inherent in those things. So for example, it's considered a perverted view that things belong to you. So, for example, in a conventional level, our shoes out in the entryway all belong to the ones who came here, right? But if you left the room, if you left tonight with different shoes that you came with, your shoes don't care. The shoes don't have no loyalty to you. That characteristic, it's mine. We assign characteristics of permanence to things. We may take things personally. We assign the idea that happiness is in the things of the world, and we assign the characteristic of happiness to that thing. And this is considered to be all perversions. And the function of emptiness is to free us from the inaccurate ways in which we characterize our experience of life, so that our experience of life can start being more accurate. And this is to be freed from perverted views, to be freed from the false characterization of how things actually are. And if you can do that, then you can dwell in nirvana. Therefore, know that the perfection of insight mantra, so this suddenly, how do I get a mantra suddenly, is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. It's a true, not false. So proclaim the perfection of insight mantra. So this is the mantra that somehow condenses or encapsulates or this profound teaching of the perfection of insight, the teaching of emptiness. Why is it so powerful, this mantra? Perhaps because people who know it and study this, by chanting this or hearing it, are reminded of this profundity. And somehow both their intellectual understanding, but also their intuitive understanding of this, is evoked by being reminded of this little teaching. And by being reminded repeatedly to trust awareness, to see the emptiness of what you're experiencing, to do that repeatedly is a protection from grasping at things, protection from having aversion towards things, to clinging. And if you don't cling, that's all you got to do as a Buddhist. It's really simple. Buddhism is really simple. It's simply don't cling. And everything else is just support for that. You can get a PhD in Buddhism. And it all comes down to...
There's a lot of footnotes.
There's a lot of footnotes. And it all comes down to don't cling. So, proclaim the perfection of insight mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. This is a very profound, important mantra. I think you were supposed to understand it, because in Sanskrit it's quite understandable. So I think when we translate it into English, it's very important to translate it, the whole thing into English, including the mantra. So the people who don't do that, I think they're actually shortchanging the people who are supposed to use this as a mantra. They kind of think it's all magical, as opposed to more... somehow the meaning has meaning. So are you ready for the English? Gata means gone. What it means is gone, not just, you know, out the door. It means gone to the other shore, gone to liberation, gone to beyond where freedom resides. Kind of transcended the world of clinging to gone to that place right here, right now, where there's no clinging at all. So it goes. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. Awake. Hallelujah. That's what it says. So please repeat after me. Gone.
Gone.
Completely gone. Completely gone. No.
Gone.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Let's do it again. Shh. This is a sacred thing you're chanting. Gone.
Gone.
Gone beyond. Gone completely beyond. Awake. Hallelujah.
That is the end, isn't it?
So, thank you. Oh, wait, one question.
This is saying then that even Buddhism is empty and it grows up, so it will pass away.
Everything is empty. Even emptiness is empty. Yes. Everything is impermanent. Even Buddhism is impermanent.
Okay.
Buddhism is very much just a created thing.
Yes.
And
even Nirvana?
Well, is Nirvana? Nirvana is not a created thing. Nirvana is unconditioned, is uncreated, is unborn. So Nirvana, in a sense, always has been, always will be, and always is. So it's the one thing which...
That's where you're going completely beyond, too.
Yeah. And
it, that
well, that's you know, some people, different schools of Buddhism will include a few other things as being unconditioned. Some people say space is also unconditioned, and so you know you can there's little elaboration, but for practical purposes for us, the only thing that's really important is Nirvana. Space is important because space is also unconditioned in a way. Space is very much like freedom. So sometimes teachers will point to space to give you kind of a sense of what freedom is like, or what the unconditioned is like. I like to point to the English expression timeless. You know, where is the timeless? We can get a sense that the present moment is timeless is in the present moment. We find now is a timeless now. But you know, was it born? Just now, he's going to die. Where is it? You know, we kind of sense of it. Some people, the sense of timelessness of the present is very important for their spirituality. But so it's unconditioned, it's uncreated. Timeless is uncreated. So Nirvana is kind of like that. It's kind of like the timeless. It's something in the present moment, something about now. That doesn't is not born, doesn't die, is always here, is not created. But it somehow is so important that if you can taste it, you'll have a taste of liberation. Oh, you know, we're one more, and then we'll stop because we're late. Emptily, I like that.
Before that, there'd be preempt.
So may you all practice emptiness. Thank you.